This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, and with me this week for our very special episode are two fantastic human beings, Tia Vasiliou.
Hello.
And Ian Boucher.
Hello. Thank you both so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Ian, I am super excited that you're here. Just before we actually get the show started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're here for today?
Certainly. I originally started my career as a video editor, but I became a librarian because I wanted to advocate for information literacy, and I'm very interested in the stories we tell each other as a culture, how the stories we tell affects what we do, and I am the editor, and I also contributed an essay to the upcoming C-Corp book, Humans and Paragons, Essays on Superhero Justice.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. You have a much cooler job, I think, than even me, and I'm a web developer, so...
I think you're the first person to ever say that. I very much appreciate it.
Mad respect for librarians, man. Seriously, you do fantastic work.
Thank you.
But yeah, we're here actually also to talk about an upcoming book that's coming out that you are the editor for, correct?
Yes.
What is this book that we're talking about? I'm going to let you just pronounce all the information because I feel like I'm going to screw it up.
I doubt that you would screw it up.
You have so much faith in me.
Likewise. Well, it's a book published by C-Court Organization. It's called Humans and Paragons, Essays on Superhero Justice. And it's an anthology that looks at superhero justice from many points of view and perspectives around the world, because we have contributors from several different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And it analyzes the many connections between the justice we tell each other about through superhero media and what we actually practice in the real world. And it also features some really tremendous insights through interviews with Mark Waid and Gerard Jones, two of my comic book heroes.
Oh, man. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was amazing to hear them talk about this topic,
mm-hmm.
and they had a lot to say. And this is a book that I'm hoping will be for anybody. You don't have to be a really in-depth superhero fan to appreciate it. That's my hope anyway. And especially like now, I mean, justice should be a central part of superheroes, but sometimes it gets moved to the side. And with superheroes so popular these days and justice around the world in such bad shape, I think it's a time when justice in stories really needs to be at the forefront, like especially with superheroes. And my hope is that this book, while certainly not the first book or group of essays to talk about superhero justice, hopefully it will be a further reminder to that people can carry with them and inspire them with their own conversations to really get this out in the open.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, just for all of our listeners out there, our regular contributor and guest on the show, Paul Jaisley, is also a contributor to this book.
Yes, he is.
Which is super exciting, and that's how we made the connection here. But T and I had a chance to read a couple of the chapters, and we're going to talk about this, in the second half of the show. But so far, it's very exciting stuff. But before we get to all of that, let's actually talk about what we read recently. So, Tia, do you want to start us off with what you read in the last week?
Sure. I'm going to start with Grizzly Shark versus Sea Bear number 3.
Nice.
By Ryan Ottley, who, for some reason, my brain auto-corrects his last name to Otterly, and so I don't know why. I just pictured this like very adorable, bewhiskered person writing this book, I guess.
So if you ever see him at a comic book convention, what you have to do is ask him to do a self-portrait as himself as an otter.
Maybe as an otter being eaten by a grizzly shark. I don't know.
Oh my goodness! Yes.
Maybe signing his book by cracking some shells
on his chest. Yeah.
Oh my goodness, yes.
I'm so sorry, Ryan. I'm so sorry. But I loved your book, and I'm telling everyone to read it because it was so much fun. And I read a lot of serious books. I don't often pick up really just goofy, silly, fun books. And to make up for this, perhaps, I actually wrote a review of it, comparing it to like the decadent literature of the 19th century and and talking about its how it's distinct from Dada literature because of its resistance to politicizing through humor.
Wow.
So I do find ways to make it horrible. I do. Ian, I don't know if you know this. I actually, I was ABD in an art history PhD, which I quit to go work in comics.
Wow.
So I, So the theorizing part of my brain does assert itself in fun and interesting ways. And Grizzly Shark versus Sea Bear is the third in the series that is focusing mainly on Grizzly Shark. So this is, I think, Sea Bear's first appearance in it so far. And I mean, I could not make this up if I tried, and I don't know how Ryan Ottley did, but basically there's like these sharks infesting a wood. I don't know how they get around. I don't know how they breathe, but like, just go with it. And they're attracted to drops of blood, like, you know, like sharks are. And there's this like guy who half of him gets eaten by a shark, and the bottom half. So like, you know, he could still talk and move around with his arms, and if he's carried by his like gigantic redneck friend. And so they're running around, and they have this like zombie-ish baby, and they're trying to help out this researcher. And then stuff goes down, and they end up in the ocean, and there's a big fight between Grizzly Shark and Sea Bear. And it's just, it's great stuff.
Wow.
It's a very insane book. I saw this, I believe I saw the first issue when I met Ryan Ottley and Jason Howard at C2E2 a couple years back, and I thought, this is insane, because the book was split in half, and Sea Bear is a character that Jason Howard draws, and Grizzly Shark is the character that Ryan Ottley draws, and oh my god.
I just could not stop laughing. Ridiculous. It was so much fun. Yeah, it's really good.
Did they both participate in this issue?
I don't think so.
No, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jason Howard's pretty busy with working on some of that book Trees with Warren Ellis.
Yeah, which is really good also.
And Ryan Ottley is on a break from Invincible while Corey Walker takes over artist duties.
Oh, okay.
So I think he's had time to produce this book.
Yeah, it's really good.
I mean, you had me with the title, but just,
I know, right?
Like, I need to read that story, even though I just heard the description of it.
Oh, it's hilarious.
It's so funny. I also read Thunderbolts number 2. I'm trying really hard to like this book because Bucky.
Thunderbolts can never be great unless Warren Ellis is writing them and Tommy Lee Jones is Norman Osborn.
Yeah. I'll read just about anything for Bucky. I'll leave it at that. More Bucky, please. And last but certainly not least, I read The Wicked and the Divine, number 20. Regular listeners of this show will know that it's my favorite thing in the universe, and I'm frequently incoherent about it. So there has been a lot of mystery surrounding Baphomet and like what his deal is and who he really is, and some answers to those questions are starting to come out in really awesome and ridiculous ways that will make you want to go back and reread everything to see all the breadcrumbs that you missed. And I love Baphomet so much, mostly because he's a colossal dick, which, I don't know, I really dig that in my fictional characters. But he actually was kind of a sweetheart in this issue, because it also answers some questions about what happened with Persephone after she ascended and, spoiler alert, was then immediately sort of killed, but not really killed, it turns out, by Ananke. So she's in hell with Baphomet, and, you know, her whole family was killed, so she's naturally very depressed. And there's this beautiful sequence of pages where she's just laying in the same place, and Baphomet is like kind of approaching her or sitting with her and just like hanging out with her and trying to cheer her up and trying to get her to eat and talking to her about comics and trying to make her laugh. And it's just really sweet. It's a really nice moment between two of my favorite characters. There's also a really interesting moment between Persephone and Cassandra, who up to this point has not been susceptible to any of the gods' powers, which is a really interesting way to assert Cassandra's kind of like stubborn, pragmatic, I'm better than you-ness. And Laura is able to communicate with Cassandra with her powers, and it's this really intense experience for Cassandra. And I just loved that moment because Cassandra is another one of my favorites in this book. And I love that the connection that she made with Persephone when she was still Laura is, to me, her being susceptible to Persephone's powers is pointing at the fact that they still have a very strong connection. And so in general, it was just a very satisfying book for me in terms of moving my favorite character stories forward. It also talks a little bit about what happened to Inanna. And I think that disappointed some people who really care about Inanna. I'm kind of ambivalent about him, so I wasn't that distraught about it. But it was a beautiful book. Matt Wilson for president, forget Eisner's, he's like, just put him in charge of everything. And
he is a very good colorist, I will say that.
Yes, it was beautiful. It was a really good book. It
sounds like a wonderful story. It does.
Do you read Victiv?
It's so...
Do you read this book, Ian?
No. I believe the books on this episode that we'll be talking about, they are all new to me, and they sound wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. Every 90 years, 12 gods are reincarnated as young people, and they're adored and feared, and they are dead within 2 years.
Oh, gosh. Adding that to the old list.
Do it. Yeah.
$10 right. For the first trade.
Oh. Yes. You know. There's 3 trades out.
Wow. How many are in each trade?
Like 5, 6?
I think, nice. Yeah, 5 or okay. 6 in the first one.
It's written by Kieran Gillen, art by Jamie McKelvey. Colors by Matt Wilson.
Yeah, if it's got one thing going for it, it's that it's a very beautiful book, and the story is actually pretty compelling too. So, you know, it's like an added bonus.
And actually, the third trade is all guest artists, because Jamie McKelvey had to take a break to do Phonogram, the Immaterial Girl. So, yeah, oh god, I can't even remember all of the great artists they have on that arc. Tula Lote, Stephanie Hans, Layla Del Duca, who else? I'm totally forgetting people. It was
that's okay.
It was good fun. Yeah,
it's very good. But you know, Ian, let's actually toss to you. What have you been reading recently?
Well, I finally read Batman: The Black Mirror, and
oh, very nice.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I first of all, I had never read a story about Gordon's son before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was fascinating. Have you guys both read it?
I have. What about you, Tia?
I don't really read DC books.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, this was a really good one for me. It was a prime example of how good a serial superhero book can be in terms of progressing the characters over time.
Totally.
This Batman is Dick Grayson. And so he's Batman for a completely different reason than Bruce Wayne. He has a completely different personality, and yet he's still Batman. And it also, in terms of like progressing Gordon's character, I don't think I've liked a Batman arc so much since like Long Halloween and Dark Victory in terms of, I mean, I don't mean like individual stories, but just reading through the whole trade and being so enthralled by it. And I don't want to give anything away, but the basics of it is that Dick Grayson comes upon this secret society that auctions off items used by supervillains in Gotham. And there are all these rich people in Gotham that sort of go incognito and to bid on these items. And at the same mm-hmm. time, Gordon's son, who may or may not have some sociopathic issues, comes back to town. And so both Dick and Gordon are sort of wrestling with the inherent goodness and badness of people, and are people inherently good or not? And it's a wonderful story. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, I have to say that Nick, who's a regular guest on the show, he recommended that book to me a long time ago, and I finally bought it and I read it, and it's honestly one of the best Batman stories I've ever read. And like, you know, you could say that about a lot of things, but just the combination of art, just the creeping weird suspense that gets built up through the entire arc is like no other. I've never read a superhero book that made me feel so creepy crawly before about regular human beings.
Okay.
You guys are convincing me. That sounds good.
Yeah, it's Jock. Alternating art between Jock and Francis Francovia. Francovia, I can never get their names right. I'm sorry.
That sounds good. Plus, Grayson, I hear that it's like compulsory to draw him with a pretty nice backside. So
yeah, you know what? I would argue that. I think I do believe there were some panels in the book now that I'm thinking about it. And also, in a weird way, I told this to a few of my friends. It's sort of like a Kill Bill Volume 3 for Long Halloween for me. And that might just be because I don't jump into Batman trades as much as I should probably. Have you guys read Long Halloween and Dark Victory?
I've read Long Halloween. I haven't read Dark Victory.
Well, Dark Victory, part of it is about Batman meeting Robin. And it's a wonderful story about Batman overcoming his failure by realizing that he doesn't have to be alone. And Robin, the role that Robin plays in his life. And so Robin's origin is part of the story. And then they also bring some of his origin into Black Mirror as well with the daughter of the mob boss that killed his family.
Right, right.
So for me, it kind of feels like now Robin's all grown up and let's see what happens next. And it's a great place to jump into the series. Although Tia, if you wind up not liking it, feel free to blame me.
Will do. Okay.
You read anything else?
Yeah, I'm always reading. Especially the last few months, things just keep piling up, and I.
Right. And,
yeah. So I have been reading a lot of the IDW Ghostbusters books.
Very cool.
And I was able to get a bunch of them at once because Humble Bundle had this wonderful charity event going on where you could get like the whole series for a really low price, and it might still be going on. I could be wrong. Maybe not by the time this airs, but So that was great. The proceeds, you could decide where they went, and there was the default thing was for a literacy program in San Francisco, I believe. But anyway, the books, I'm a big Ghostbusters fan, because not just because of the comedy, but because of the creative paranormal stories that mm-hmm. that the movies have, even with the flaws, especially of the second one. They're both, like, it could have easily been just like the stereotypical, like, Casper, the friendly ghost, like, haunting people. But the first movie's about an ancient Sumerian god, and then the second one is about slime that is affected, that manifests through people's emotions. That stuff's fascinating.
That's crazy.
And so the books, I feel like they capture the voices of the characters. Like, I felt like I was hearing the actors speaking a lot of the lines, and it's funny. It's creative with the paranormal aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I feel like a little bit toward the end of series two, there's something that happens that I sort of made me feel like I got punched in the gut, but I'm hoping that I trust the writers and the artists that everything will make sense in the end. But there's something really dramatic that happens near the end of the second series, and they actually do a great comic book reference about it as well that I won't give away. The books are full of visual and text references to things. Like, you could be looking at a street corner, and in the background driving by, you'll see one of the old toy cars from Ghostbusters, or you'll see like Mork and Mindy and like really, really deep stuff. And even there's like a certificate on the background of a panel that references a way that the movie was censored on TV. And I only know that because I used to, the first times I would watch the movie, it was on TV so much before I finally caught it on DVD and such. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's a highly enjoyable series, and I've been highly enjoying it a lot.
Very cool. I've never read any Ghostbusters. I always tend to shy away, and in previous episodes I've talked about how I usually shy away from licensed books like that, but I mean, I think people are taking books like that and they're going in very, very cool directions for you know, referencing source material or creating very unique stories within the, you know, specific universe of these types of books. So that's, I'm glad to hear someone's reading Ghostbusters, because I've heard good things, at least about the most recent runs. So that's cool.
Yeah, and I was a little bit hesitant to pick it up because I'm not usually one just for licensed series, because of, it's just like, oh, yay, nostalgia. Oh, there's a treasure troll in this. That means it's good writing. Like, I don't, for me, a story isn't interesting just because of the nostalgia. It needs some meat. And these stories definitely have meat. And I wish that they would make movies based on these comics. That would be fantastic. Instead of sort of trying to rehash the same kind of story.
Right, right.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely recommend picking it up.
Cool. Well, I'm gonna just jump in and just go over the few comics that I read recently, because I have been wildly busy after work and things like that. I haven't had time to actually sit down and read too much, but I did manage to read a couple books. I've been slowly making my way through Mark Waid's run of Daredevil from 2012.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is a fantastic book. I only read a couple of issues, but it's dealing with the Omega Drive. So anyone who maybe read that series back then maybe has seen that. But I just got through a little bit of that. I mean, the art in that book is so fantastic. They had Coy Pham on for two issues that I read, and I was like,
yeah,
wow, I don't know. That book was so fantastic. I'm kind of bummed that I wasn't buying it when it was coming out, but I'm so glad that I own it now. Let's see. I also read issue number two of a book that I mentioned last week called Chunks, which is a Comixology submit book about a punk band who's touring across the United States. They're from England. And in issue two, they get a record deal and everything goes to shit because tropes, right? And so it's actually a really funny book. They throw in some weird British humor. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, like, British rhyming thing where someone would say something like, "Slow it down, old China," which means China means China, and China is a plate. Plate rhymes with mate, so slow it down, old friend.
Isn't that a convention of, like, Cockney speech?
Yes, yes. There's an actual name for it. I cannot remember what it is. But throughout this series, like, every couple of pages, you know, they'll throw in one of the characters uses that, and he says something, and then in a small box in the bottom of the panel, they'll say, this is actually what he meant. He didn't just call someone a piece of China.
Nice.
You know?
So it's cultural education on top of just being fun.
Yeah. And this is like a straightforward, just fun, dumb book, and they definitely took a jab at that series that came out I can't remember what it was called, that... There was a whole controversy about the way that they had talked about transvestites in the series, and it was they totally just slapped that book in the face. I absolutely loved it. So it's a fun book. It's still very good, just like punk rock is stupid kind of thing. Or punk rock is, it's not that it's stupid, but just like the ridiculous things that you think about when you think of the most cliched punk band from the UK existing in a modern era.
I'll have to check that one out too.
Yeah, it's like, I think the issues are 99 cents or maybe $1.99 each for, you know, 22 or 30 pages. So it's well worth your cash. It's digital only right now, and I have a feeling they'll probably do a print version at some point. And the other book that I read was another Comixology submit book called Lucky, which is a historical comic book about a gangster named Luciano, whose name, I can't remember what his first name was, or Charlie Luciano, I think. It's written by Christian, I'm going to butcher this name, I feel so bad, Christian Cipollini, and with art by... I'm just not even gonna try. This guy's, it's a very, very tough name, but it's a very cool book. Like, I didn't realize until halfway through that this was actually based on real history. So it's an entertaining mob book. It's all about mobsters and the crime in the late 20s, early 30s. So if you're into something like Boardwalk Empire, or you want to see other mobsters other than Al Capone, this is a really cool book about a guy whose face gets maimed and how he takes revenge on the gangsters who did it to him. So Yeah, I went in a weird direction this week with comics. I didn't read my classic superhero books. Instead, I just read, you know, other things that I could get my hands off. You know, on top of Daredevil, because Daredevil's great, and it doesn't count. It's just a great noir book, I guess.
Every book counts.
Yeah. But anyway, so let's move on and talk about what we're excited for this upcoming week. So, Ian, I'm actually going to throw back to you. What are you excited for this upcoming week?
Well, I'm really excited for Black Panther number 3, and I think Future Quest number 2 is coming out. I grew up watching a lot of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and I thought it was a fun concept, and I really enjoyed issue 1. I heard you guys talking about it on one of your episodes, and I completely agree with the beautiful art and the fun science fiction spirit. So I'm looking forward to see where that goes. Mm-hmm. And maybe they'll also throw in some Space Ghost Coast to Coast references as well as classic Space
Ghost. We can only hope.
Yes. More Brack, please. and with Black Panther number 3, I have really found this series refreshing in terms of there are so many comic books now where the art is beautiful. I mean, like mainstream superhero books, where the art is beautiful, but then you don't have to really read that much and you kind of glide through it. But with this series so far, you really have to read these panels. I feel like it combines the reading of the 1980s with the art of today, with the writing of an author like Ta-Nehisi Coates in there. Like he's really bringing his craft to this book. I read Between the World and Me, and then I was thinking about picking up the Black Panther series, and then I was in the store, and I'm walking over to the checkout, and I'm like, wait a second, he wrote Black Panther. And I was like, oh my gosh, and I sent it to a bunch of my colleagues. I work at a college, and we had just read the book as a group together, and had a great discussion about it, and they were like, oh my gosh.
That's awesome.
He's really bringing his voice to this medium, and I've really been enjoying it a lot, so I'm looking forward to where the series will be going.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and read that book, but I think I'm going to collect it in trade because it's a very important book, I think, for Marvel right now, and it's definitely worth the read from what I've been told by you as well as a handful of other people. So, you know, good books are good books, and I'm glad that Marvel's actually, you know, taking a chance with a writer who's not from their regular, you know, pool of people.
Yeah.
He's talked about being a huge comics fan and how I think Spider-Man really influenced him. So he definitely is in a comics headspace. And so it's nice, yeah, to have them kind of open the gates and bring him in, because it sounds like it's not a new headspace for him.
Yeah.
It's just a new medium to be writing for.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think at the end of the first issue, maybe it's the second one, he writes a great letter about just how crazy this experience is writing for Marvel now, being a fan.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Tia, what are you excited for this week?
I'm really excited for Han Solo number 1. This is, I think, going to be a mini series. Marjorie Liu is writing it, which is fantastic. I love her creator-owned work. I love her work that she's done for Marvel. And I'm really thrilled that they have a woman writing Han Solo, because I feel like women see Han Solo very differently than men see him. I've never understood why Han Solo has this reputation of being a kind of smooth operator, womanizing kind of character. He's such a dork. He's like
totally
the biggest
is.
Dork in the galaxy. And I think that makes him very charming. And so I really hope that Marjorie Liu brings that out. And it's the description that is on the Marvel site really emphasizes what a scoundrel he is, what a lovable scoundrel. And it sounds like the premise of the book is that he's doing some undercover work for the rebellion. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of like peak Han Solo dork worming his way out of situations that just makes him so great.
Peak Han Solo. Oh my gosh, I love that idea.
Well, it really does bring a new perspective when he's like on the intercom. Oh, we're all fine here.
Everything's fine. If you go back and look at all of those, there's so many of those moments in the original three movies. He just is, it's like, Han, who are you kidding? You're right. Lucky you're cute.
Well, that's the thing. They always portrayed him in the movies like he's this smooth guy.
No.
I should say, the idea of that Han has of himself is that he's the smoothest, coolest guy in the universe. But whenever you actually see him try to do anything smooth, he's such a doofus about
exactly. it. Exactly. I have a lot of faith in Marjorie Liu, so I'm sure it's going to be great.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, I didn't even realize this was coming out this week. This is, my wallet is being damaged by all of these, these random Star Wars books. It started with Poe Dameron, and now I'm falling down into the well.
It helps, I think Darth Vader is ending, which super sad face, because that one's also been really funny in a weird way.
That's what I've heard.
The murder droids, and yeah.
Cool. Well, for me this week, I'm excited about Invincible number 129, which is coming out. I believe this is the second to last issue with Corey Walker, if not maybe the last, with the Mark Grayson has come back from the past and now everything's awful. And it's so sad. Like, this book has a great way with exploring the emotions of a superhero and how when someone goes in the past and they come back to the future and everything's changed, they don't just get along. They are seriously damaged as a human being. And I think Robert Kirkman has done a fantastic job of exploring that with Mark as a character, with his wife, Adam Eve, and how Mark is trying to deal with the fact that his daughter is grown up, even though the last time he saw her, she was a baby. And this book just constantly breaks my heart in a way that makes me want more of this book. Like, I want to see Mark survive this. I want to see him manage to cope with all of the problems that he's facing.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a great comic book. Like, exploring the emotional depth of a superhero character is something I think a lot of mainstream, you know, big two books try to do, but it's always I guess, like, taken over by, like, action and all the various, you know, adventure-y, good time things that you see where we gotta fight the bad guy. This book isn't about fighting the bad guy so much. It's about really making, like, feeling and understanding who Mark is as a character. And I cannot sell this book anymore. Invincible's 129 issues in, and since issue one, I have felt, like, a deep connection with this character, and I have to credit Robert Kirkman for that. And all of the creative teams that have been able to portray the emotion and feelings of this character, as well as all of the supporting characters in this book. So Invincible's a hard sell because it's so long and you have to read it for a really long time. But the payoff, this book pays itself off like 100 times over. Like, every arc ends in such a way that is satisfying and leaves you wanting more of the book. So that's all I can say about Invincible. This book is still one of my favorites to this day.
I just have a big smile on my face. Like, that's what I hear about that series a lot, and I haven't gotten into it yet, but that's always what I hear, is how it just keeps paying off and paying off and paying off.
Like I said, it's a real big endeavor, but it is very, very much worth it. Ian, you gave us a little bit of an intro about this book, you know, earlier in the episode when we introduced you, but, you know, could you tell us a little bit about how, you know, Superhero Justice, this book got started, and like what brought you to say, you know, instead of writing just an article online, I want to actually put a book together to publish a whole plethora of information about Superhero Justice?
Absolutely. Well, I started I had been contributing a few articles for secourt.org. At the time, this was like summer 2014, when for my next piece, I wanted to write about Wonder Woman's brand of justice. I had not grown up as a Wonder Woman fan. Of course, I was aware of her, but I wasn't really interested in her because I knew that all I knew about her was that she was tough and that she had like a vague array of powers. This was just my childhood thinking. And in 2014, I picked up Gail Simone's The Circle, because I was like, I want to learn about Wonder Woman for the first time. And I think it was also prompted by a fan film, a really, really beautiful looking fan film that somebody had made of Wonder Woman battling like gods and monsters and stuff. But at the same time in that movie, it was like, she's just tough. It's like, what else is there to her? And so I wanted to learn about her before Batman Superman was coming out. And the whole DC extended, expanded universe?
Yeah, I don't know. They don't really have a name for it.
DCEU?
Yeah.
Well, I know the initials are DCEU. But anyway, I wanted to learn about her. And so I picked up Gail Simone's The Circle, and I was blown away by her brand of justice, like in that it very much echoed real life restorative justice, which builds bridges between offenders and victims and the community to try to create harmony, which really should be justice's end goal. And it got me thinking about how so much superhero media is just about catching the bad guys or killing the bad guys. Sometimes even comedically, it's like, oh, they're blown up. Oh, this is funny. Yay.
Right.
And which, you know, superheroes, that's like their role, is to catch bad guys most of the time. So I wanted to write this article about Wonder Woman, and as I was talking to my interviewees who worked in the criminal justice system about this topic, I just was thinking how this is so much of a larger topic than what I'm addressing here, and of course I was aware of other essays that had been written on superhero justice, even though I wasn't very familiar with them, I knew that they were out there. And so I asked Sequart if, because I know that they do some book publications and some documentaries, if they would be interested in doing this as a topic. And I do have a TV and film production background, however small. and I also obviously liked to write. And so I was like, would you guys be interested in this? And they said, well, they asked about my background, and then they said, well, what do you think? And out of everything I can do, really all I have is words in the page. Like that's where I think I have the most potential in, creatively speaking. So I thought that a book would be a great way to go. And it would also be great to have a bunch of people's thoughts out there in more detail, all collected together, something people could carry with them and flip through and think about and make notes on. And that's how the book got started.
So as far as, you know, finding other writers for this book, because obviously this book is like a series of essays written by different people, as you had mentioned, with various backgrounds from all over the world, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, several different countries.
Right. So how did you go about recruiting these people? I believe you said some of them work for Sequart, but others did you just find online or people that you knew?
The vast majority of them had been contributors to Sequart, including our writer from Spain and our writer from Poland.
Okay.
But some of the other writers were people that I knew. One of them, have you guys heard of Ross May? He wrote an independent book called Devil Dealers, and he also did some work with Tales of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I can't say that I have.
Okay, well, I had reviewed Devil Dealers for Sequart, so sort of through Sequart, I had been in contact with him a little bit, and I asked him about it independently. And also, Rebecca Johnson of Supergirl Radio, I had become acquainted with her over Twitter. We both bonded over Man of Steel.
Okay.
And so I asked her about it because I knew that she would have a lot of interesting things to say. But the vast majority of the contributors had written essays or book essays for Sequart before.
Very cool. Okay, yeah. So, and as far as like topic choices and things like that, obviously all of the essays are revolved around various levels of how superheroes interpret justice or how their stories use justice as part of their narrative. Was there like a, you have to write about this character, you have to write about this character, or anything like that? Because, I mean, some of the chapters, you gave us like some samples and you gave us some outlines of what the chapters are going to be about. It's very DC-centric. There's a, And then there's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles story. And in your specific essay, you cover a whole plethora of characters. So was there like a direction you gave to people, or was it just, you know, here's what we want to talk about, find the best way to convey your idea?
Yes, there was an overall direction of the book. I wanted it to start with how our cultural understandings of justice in popular culture came about. I wanted to do that for the first section, to sort of create the backdrop and lay the groundwork for everything. Mm-hmm. And I was even hoping that somebody, and for each section I did lay out some ideas that I wanted and things that I would hope that people would be interested in writing about. And so, like, for the first section, my ideal first section would have been something going all the way back to ancient times and going through Victorian ideals of justice and literature and going through all the way up to today in various media and stuff. But
quite an endeavor.
Yeah.
You can go back to ancient pottery or Parthenon friezes. I mean, sequential narrative is nothing new in Western culture. So you definitely, if you have the time and the ink that you want to spill, I think you could reach pretty far back.
Yeah, and even outside of sequential art, just in terms of the stories we tell each other overall, like Gilgamesh, for instance, or then you have up in the 1800s, you have like Great Expectations with the criminal, or of course Les Miserables.
Well, and genre fiction in general has been tied to a lot of moralizing and social hand wringing since the novel what became popular, basically, in particular as it would relate to women or anyone who might be perceived as easily influenced. I think that Paul's chapter on Four Color Morality talks a lot about the comics code and how people were so anxious about the influence that these stories were going to have on the impressionable minds of young people. And this, I mean, you can trace this back through history to with genre fiction. So it's definitely rooted in the way that Western culture has dealt with this particular art form for a while.
Absolutely, and it's always there. And our understandings of things didn't just come from nowhere. And the myths that we perpetuate don't just come from nowhere. They have origins, and it's crucial to think about them, to be able to look outside of the diorama that you live in.
Yeah. Having said that, you certainly have to pick some parameters when you're approaching a topic like this, or you just will never get anything done. So, right. What was your thinking when you were trying to kind of define a moment to really focus on with these essays?
Well, I wanted it to go from, and I apologize, I went off on a little bit of a tangent there.
No, that's fine.
I wanted the overall logic of the book, I wanted it to take the reader on a journey from the context of things to the assumptions that we have to what happens when these assumptions become solidified, and then thinking about going into the future. And a lot of the pitches, they related to things within that journey of logic. But of course, with each contributor, they also bring their own ideas. So I worked with the contributors to shape their essays within that logic, if that makes sense.
And you're trying to keep the focus on more contemporary ideals of justice. Like, how did you decide what moment in time that you wanted to really be looking at with this connection that you saw?
Yeah, great question. I think that my starting point is definitely the war on drugs. That has incredibly affected things for the worse around the world. The U.S. has tremendous influence around the world, and the American criminal justice system revolves a great deal around that. Certainly not everything, but the vast majority of the reason why America has the highest incarceration rate in the world is because of the war on drugs. So I sort of wanted to start, I wanted to start with where that, where our present came from. And the different writers, they addressed it in their own ways, and the topics that they explored them through their own topics. So there are essays about things from the 1980s. There are essays about modern film. I would say that I kind of just started with the war on drugs and went from there.
You definitely, in your essay, posit it as a really pivotal moment. So I think that in your introduction, it does set that up for being the kind of front end of the bookend that you're trying to work within. And I don't know, having finished this book, are you optimistic for the other end of that bookend, or are we doomed?
I'm definitely optimistic. As a librarian, I see hope every single day, and nobody's going to convince me of that otherwise. Like the other day, a student just told me that they're going to be more critical of reviews after seeing X-Men Apocalypse and liking it.
Think for yourself, everyone.
Exactly. Yeah, make your own decisions. Yeah. So I see hope every day, and I also think with the comics industry, comics being the wellspring of superheroes, with that opening up more opportunities for different voices to, based on my understandings of the industry, because I don't work in the industry, but based on what I've learned about it, it sounds like there are more voices coming into the industry now. So that brings hope right there. But I do think that hope isn't going to be enough. People need to be active. And that's why this book is so important to me, and getting this conversation not started, but further out into the mainstream among academics and general audiences. It's so important for everybody to be aware of this and to start talking more about it. And I think there's a lot of potential, but we need to keep this alive and be active within it, even just in our conversations. Even if you just want to get a Wonder Woman mug and put it on your desk at work, and people can be like, oh, what's that? Oh, well, it's a Wonder Woman mug. Well, why do you have a Wonder Woman mug? Well, funny you should ask.
And then you just hit them with the story about how justice is wrong in this country. No,
exactly.
It's like
Wonder Woman's cool because she is all about harmony, and just keeping those other voices alive. And I talk about this in my essay where we live in a time when superheroes are so popular, and yet on the show The Flash, I eventually had to stop watching it, and one of the reasons was because you have Cisco, who's like, and I've heard that he's gotten more complex since when I stopped watching it, and I hope I didn't completely turn off everybody in the entire universe right now.
Well, I'm about to end this whole podcast right now because
of that
phrase.
I don't even watch The Flash.
I'm kidding, Mike.
Well, when, like, you have Cisco, like, yay, I'm naming bad guys and we're catching bad guys and this is so fun. But when I was watching it, I didn't really see him being reined in by that. And so it's important to have a variety of characters being just as popular.
Well, I think anti-heroes are really popular. And I don't think that anyone sees them as role models for real life, but that there is something satisfying about their particular brand of justice being played out fictionally.
I think that's a really short-sighted thing that we all, you know, we take that and we say, oh, that's really satisfying. But in retrospect, you know, I think a lot of times we'll go, well, that's actually not the right way to approach this, despite how good it felt in the moment.
But it's more intellectually honest. I mean, I am sorry, Matt Murdock, but not everyone you hit in the head or throw off a building is surviving that. So, like, at least Frank Castle is honest about what he's doing.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
That's something that I actually found really interesting about, I think it was Paul's article, and it was about the article about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by the guy's name, who I'm sorry, I can't recall. by John Lloyd, that he talked about, they both talked about the idea that, yes, you may be crippling this person, but is that really the right way to solve this problem? You know, saying, well, they're never going to be a bad guy again. Like, does that actually solve the problem, or should there be, you know, repercussions because of that? And I think a lot of the idea of this book is talking about, you know, the what is actually right and wrong, which I seems very obvious now that I say it, but we always overlook that idea that, yeah, Batman just beat up 20 guys and he knocked them unconscious, and maybe some of them aren't going to make it through that severe beating they were just given, yet we go, well, he didn't kill them, so it's totally okay, despite, you know, the origins of that character being that he was throwing people off buildings and he was using a gun to shoot, you know, mobsters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, this goes back, I think, to Ian's point about optimism, because the logical conclusion of the argument that, well, I crippled this bad guy so he won't be bad anymore because he physically can't, assumes that no bad guys are rehabilitatable, yeah. If that is a word. Is that a word?
I think it is now. Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that I feel like I'm blinking right now, but there are characters in comics who are rehabilitated bad guys who decide to start working for the good guys. And I don't know, just the American criminal justice system seems to be really draconian in its ideas about rehabilitation, whereas there are other Western countries with much gentler sentences for very serious crimes, but that operate under the idea that people can change if you are kind to them and teach them how.
Yeah, and there are other things that we put people away for that aren't completely diagnosed. I read an interesting book that talked about sex offenders and how different disorders are diagnosed and what they're being put away for. But also in the bigger picture, in general with crime, the literature agrees that there are so many other more effective ways of making crime better than just growing prisons.
Right. Well, and on top of this, you know, we have a cultural stigma that, you know, if you've been caught, or you've, you know, something's happened where you've committed a crime and you've been, you know, sent to jail, or you've been caught for whatever reason, like, then you're labeled as an outcast forever. Yep. After that, you know, you have to, if you commit a felony, you know, you have to put it on your applications for some jobs, and that, like, totally potentially outs you for a position, meaning that despite your rehabilitation, you are still stigmatized, you still can't become a regular member of society.
And most people
again
in the country are put away for nonviolent low-level drug crimes, like, they're not even the kingpins of the world, they're more like the Turks of the world. And Turk is a Daredevil character. I'm not referring to Turkey as a country. And even labeling them as Turk is bad. But anyway, most people are put away in this country for low-level, nonviolent drug crimes, and it's not, they're no worse at doing drugs than other people. Research finds that most people, like drugs are done by people at generally the same rate across race, across economic status, all that stuff. It's just that the laws are enforced more in the poorer, more urban, non-white areas, and so it's like the problem itself of crime isn't even being addressed properly. It's just being enforced in certain places. And then when you look at it in a city, you'll be like, oh, that's a crime problem. In the suburbs, you would say, oh, that's a health problem. Mm-hmm. You know,
it certainly does come across as a kind of justice theater in a lot of ways, and you really have to ask who the audience is.
And the audience is a lot of times, like, a lot of the war on drugs came about not because of real crime rates, but because politicians wanted to get votes from poor rural white communities, just to get votes.
Interesting.
I've read that too. If you look at the way that the Republican Party got in bed with the Christian right, it's the exact same. It parallels it almost exactly. So it's interesting how politics and power really are obscured by these other social issues that we encounter on a daily basis in our lives and also in the arts and media that we consume. And it's really great to have books like yours and that are encouraging people to kind of look behind the curtain.
Yeah.
A crucial question with all this is, well, these are stories for entertainment, so what role does this play in a superhero story? And that's gonna vary depending on what each author wants to say, what story they want to tell. But at the same time, you know, we expect people to be portrayed accurately. Why don't we expect other elements of society to be portrayed accurately, like how the justice system works? It's like for me, a lot of superhero media, the further you get away from comics anyway, it's sort of like watching an old Hollywood movie where they're in the jungle in Asia and you hear a kookaburra in the background. I don't know if you guys get that reference or not.
That might be a little over my head.
A kookaburra is a bird in Australia. It sounds like it's laughing. If you type in, everybody listening, if you go on YouTube and look up kookaburra, I think you'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I can sing an Australia children's song right now about the kookaburra laughing in a tree.
That's what came to my mind when you said kookaburras. But, you know, nonetheless, but the point is that, like, it's out of place.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or it's constructed in an artificial way that's kind of an amalgamation of a bunch of elements that don't actually go together
Why would you say that the world works this way when it really doesn't? Just because it's just what you think of without actually knowing it.
Well, and I think it's hard because sometimes that sort of dissonance can be useful. But if you aren't looking at the seams, it becomes normal.
Absolutely. And so I am optimistic as long as people keep having this conversation. And there's going to be a lot of debates and disagreements on things along the way. As long as people are honest with themselves and with each other, I do have hope. And I hope that as comics change, then it can also go into other media. And there are plenty of examples in other media as well that are interesting, like Spider-Man 3. Despite its problems, it's all about, well, what really happened to Uncle Ben. And then in the Daredevil show, you also have it deals with human trafficking a little bit. So there are plenty of pockets that we can hold on to and cultivate to make better.
Ian, are you Team Stark? Are you reading Civil War?
I'm not reading the new Civil War. I read the original one, and
you should check out the new one. It's it's basically a question of should criminal justice, or in this case, intergalactic justice, be carried out through precognition.
Yeah, and I was sort of disappointed when I heard it was about that, because I was like, well, that's like Minority Report and a bunch of other sci-fi.
It is a little like Minority Report.
Do you feel like it's different enough than those, though? Like it's its own thing with that topic?
I mean, I do think that it is, if we're talking about it vis-a-vis your book, which is the idea of real life criminal justice, there are certainly times and people who are not given the benefit of innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, and they're not. Yeah, and it doesn't even go that far to the question, because lawyers in the system, they will want somebody to plead a certain way just to be able to get it done and move on and
right.
Or lower because they know that that's the best option for this defendant who just doesn't actually have a chance at getting a fair shake. So yeah, I think that. In light of your interest in how superhero comic book justice is having a conversation with real life American justice, you might be interested.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like specifically the superhero role in all of it, and yeah, what's the question in Captain America 2? I thought sentence happened after the crime or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tia, you are a resident expert on Winter Soldier. You should know this.
Who is the Winter Soldier? I'm just kidding.
Wasn't his fault, okay?
Oh, no, that's we can't move the podcast that direction. That would be a whole nother hour of recording.
But, yeah, I don't know which team I'm on. I'm still mulling over the Civil War question in the books because it's a complex one. Mm. It's a very, very complex one. But certainly... What in Civil War II is Tony against the getting somebody before they do anything?
Yeah, because his argument is, well, it didn't happen because we stopped it. So obviously the precog vision is only a version of the future and not set in stone. So how can we what is its actual probability ratio here?
Oh, man. Tentatively speaking, it sounds like I'm on Team Stark for this one.
Yeah, me too, which is so hard because love Carol Danvers so much.
And I do mention a second in the book, I wish I could have written more about it, the higher, faster, further, more story. That delves into a lot of really interesting things
This is a Captain Marvel story talking about?
Okay. Kelly Sue DeConnick.
Just want to make sure I wasn't familiar with it.
She's going to help this other planet's situation, and it's like, oh, well, you think you can just come here and punch stuff and everything will be okay? And then there's like another character who's like a troubled teen, and it's like, well, what should we be doing to help this teen and stuff? There's a lot of really interesting stuff in that story.
Speaking of Kelly Sue DeConnick and criminal justice, have you read any Bitch Planet?
Oh, man, you stole my question, Tia.
Sorry, Mike. Which one of us has a non-compliant tattoo? Bitch Planet is my question.
Okay.
I still haven't read it yet, but I plan on it, definitely. I enjoy Kelly Sue DeConnick a great deal. I think she's a really cool person. And also, Army Brat represent.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, actually along those lines, talking about independent comics, I know like the book covers a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle story, but a lot of this book covers, you know, DC and Marvel characters in specific because we're talking about superheroes and we're talking about superhero justice. And so, you know, pinning it on the big two seems to make a lot of sense. But do you think that we could find examples of the type of justice or the types of stories that we should be looking at about, you know, justice in general in independent comics? Or are there any that come to mind for you?
I would have to think about which ones come to mind. I mean, certainly the Turtles do. But whether superheroes or not, anything that deals with justice is relevant to the conversation. Everything has potential mm-hmm. to think about how well did this do, how well did this not do. You could debate it, but I don't know if this would count as superhero, but one of my favorite indie books is the Usagi Yojimbo series, and that certainly has a lot of things to mine from, to mull over and chew on in terms of what justice means in general. Anything that deals with that theme has relevance, and you can think about it.
Totally. I mean, I think of, you know, I'm trying to think of a lot of other books that I read that are, you know, have to deal with what's considered right versus wrong and how they deal with the law in that regard. And I think that the further away you get from the big two stories, the more you get into various shades of gray and, you know, is the law even correct versus what we think is correct as the reader or is what the characters think. And I think it gets really complex and much harder to discern what is actually right and wrong, which makes stories very interesting for that specific reason.
And it starts conversations and it gets people talking about it. And that's the only way you're going to figure things out is by analyzing it with other people, because everybody's going to have their own perspectives on it.
And to bring this back into real life action sort of things that we can do to make things a little more optimistic moving forward, are there any legal criminal defense charities or organizations that you support, that you promote, that you would encourage people to donate to or get involved with?
I would encourage everybody to start by reading The New Jim Crow. Start there, and it provides so many options for real action. there's a whole section in the book about how so much of, since so much of the criminal justice system is really just based on race, there's a whole section in the book about how so much of the civil rights action in this country is based on things, strategies from the 60s, and it presents ideas for how to make change more, not even efficient, just more possible.
More relevant in the current cultural climate.
Yeah, more like just effective, period. And also in the many citations that the book has, not only does it present places where you can research more, but it provides like some organizations that you can learn about and get involved with. And I do also want to interrupt real quick.
Cool.
That I just thought of another indie character that I do reference for a second in the introduction. I don't know if you guys caught it, but I did reference Judge Dredd.
Oh, I did hear that. I am the law. That was, I heard it. I heard it in my head. So, okay. I want to wrap this up real quick. And, you know, ask two small questions to you. One, well, maybe one's actually pretty big. The other is kind of small. One, when can we expect this book to be published? I think you had mentioned sometime in July. I don't know if you have an actual date.
Yeah, I was, when we were first putting the podcast together, I was told July, and I just checked with Sequart again yesterday, and I still don't have a date yet, but they are hoping for it to be published sometime this summer.
Okay.
And maybe even by the time the podcast is posted, we'll have a date. But there isn't one yet. But if you do go to sequart.org and go to at the top of the page where it says books, if you roll your mouse over it, there's a forthcoming section in the dropdown. And you can find a page for us there if you want to bookmark it and stay up to date on how things are going. And you can always ask me on Twitter, too. So
cool. Yeah, we'll post a bunch of links to all the various things that we've referenced this week, or in this episode, I should say. And yeah, so my last question is, if you could recommend any one book or collected edition or even omnibus of stories that you would say, like, this embodies what I think is a good story about superhero justice,
oh my
what
gosh.
Would it be? I know it's a huge question, so if you need to take some time, we'll cut out the big pause. But
I think that Ian is just sort of going to, like, shut down. It sounds like his brain is malfunctioning.
You know the fembots in Austin Powers when they're overloading? That's me right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're shooting lasers out of your boobs?
Yes.
Definitely Wonder Woman The Circle, Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Mark Waid's Green Hornet run. Mm-hmm. And you will be able to tell, if not while you're reading the story, definitely by the last few very hard-hitting, amazing panels.
This
one is, I'm sort of on fence somewhat about this because the 1970s Luke Cage stories, because they're very like blaxploitation stories. But at the same time, it gets you thinking a lot about just this, there's this whole other aspect of American society that is not talked about a lot. And that is the world that Luke Cage lives in, where his secret identity is not just his name. It's his status as an ex-convict. He's like worried about people finding out about that. Peter Parker's like, oh, people are going to find out I'm Spider-Man. He's like, oh, Luke Cage is like, people are going to find out that I was wrongly committed of a crime, but except without the wrongly committed part, they're just going to assume I'm a criminal. And
right.
And in some of the stories, he has a police officer friend who there are great juxtapositions between that officer's home life in the suburb and Luke Cage's life. But at the same time, Luke Cage is just a fascinating character. He has a great supporting cast and he's entertaining to read. He's a great superhero that touches on a lot of these topics. But there is that blaxploitation element, too. And so that's a really, really interesting book. Martian Manhunter, American Secrets by Gerard Jones. It analyzes American media through the lens of the 1950s, but still. The Kelly Sue DeConnick story, Higher, Faster, Furthermore with Captain Marvel. The Batgirl story by Gail Simone, volume one of New 52, the mirror. But yeah, that deals with a lot of things.
Oh yeah,
that's just in terms of like police processes and law process. And there are many, many more where that. Oh my gosh! Wait. The Green Lantern, Green Arrow series, of course.
Yeah, obviously.
By Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams in the 70s. But
okay.
Even though comic book discourse wants you to think that everything is now okay because of that series, and it's not, I would still want you to read that series because it's amazing.
All right. Cool. Well, Ian, this has been absolutely fantastic. I very, very much look forward to reading this full book. Like, I read a couple, you know, I read two chapters. I'm really looking forward to read the rest of the book. We will be posting links to all these different things in the show notes. But thank you so much for being on our show. This has been a fantastic time. I mean, for everything we talked about on the show as well as outside of the recording, like, you are an absolute treasure, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's an honor to be here, and the most inspiring thing to me is that other people are interested in this conversation, and I get more hope with each conversation.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Deluxe and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Deluxe on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/deluxe-cmr. And you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.com. As Mike mentioned last week, we'll be on break here for a little bit. We're taking the next month off to collect ourselves, make plans, and continue making a quality show for you. This doesn't mean the show will be off the air, so to speak. We'll still be releasing an episode each week, shorter episodes, mini-sodes, if you will, where we get together and chat about some of our favorite series. If that's not your bag, and you absolutely need more I Read Comic Books in your life, check out our backlog of episodes on ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. And remember, if you enjoy this show, tell someone about it, rate us online, or write to us. You can contact us at ircb@destroythesybe.org. You can also find the entire podcast team on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. And don't forget, you can join and spark conversations over on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.